FM Now, our new book of the week is the acclaimed actor Alan Cumming's powerful new memoir. Not My Father's Son tells the story of Alan's complex relationship with his violent father and a deeply buried family mystery.
You need a haircut, boy. My father had only glanced at me across the kitchen table as he spoke, but I had already seen in his eyes the coming storm. As usual, we had eaten our evening meal in near silence. Until recently, my older brother Tom would have been seated where I was, helping to deflect the gaze of impending rage that was now focused entirely upon me. But Tom had a job now. He left every morning in a shirt and tie, and our father hated him for it. Tom was no longer in his thrall. Tom had escaped. I hadn't been so lucky yet. My mother tried to intervene. "I'll take him to the barber's on Saturday morning, Ali," she said.
"He'll be working on Saturday. He's not getting away with slouching off his work again. There's too much of that going on in this house. Do you hear me?"
Now it wasn't just a haircut. It was my physical shortcomings as a labourer, my inability to perform the tasks he gave me every weekend and many evenings, tasks I was unable to perform because I was 12, but mostly because he wanted me to fail at them so he could hit me. "I can get one tomorrow at school lunchtime." My voice trailed off in that way I knew sounded too pleading, too weak, but I couldn't help it. "Yes, do that, pet," my mum said. I could sense the optimism in her tone and I loved her for it. But I knew it was false optimism. Denial. This was going to end badly and there was no way to prevent it. Every night, getting off the school bus, walking through the gates of the estate where we lived, past the sawmill yard where my father reigned, and towards our house was like a lottery. Would he be home yet? What mood would he be in? My father was the head forester of Panmure Estate, near Carnoustie, on the east coast of Scotland. The estate was vast, with 50 farms and thousands of acres of woodland covering over 21 square miles of land. We lived on what was known as the estate premises, the grounds of Panmure House, though by the time we lived there, the big house was long gone. I didn't know it at the time, but I was living to the end of an era of grand Scottish estates. Looking back on it, it was a beautiful place to grow up. But at the time, all I wanted was to get as far away as possible. There was a lump of fear stuck at the top of my chest that made it hard to swallow. I had to get some water or I was going to choke, or worse, cry. I got up from the table and moved towards the sink. "What the hell do you think you're doing?" he said, not quite shouting yet, but still too loud, as though he had been waiting to say it. Eager to make the next move, and now, here it was.
"Hey, did you hear me?"
"I need to drink some water," I gasped.
"Put that glass down."
My father rose from his chair and everything went red. At the same time as he began shouting at me, he grabbed me by the scruff of the neck and I was being dragged across the kitchen, out through the porch and the front door and across the yard to the shed where we kept our bikes. He threw me up on top of a workbench. There was a lone, bare light bulb hanging from the shed ceiling. I remember looking up at it as he scrambled in a drawer behind me. Soon, my head was propelled forward by his hand, the other one wielding a rusty pair of clippers that he used on the sheep we had in the field in front of our house. They were blunt and dirty and they cut my skin, but my father shaved my head with them, holding me down like an animal. Eventually, it was over. He pushed my head one way, then the other, in order to inspect his work, then threw the clippers back in the drawer. He whacked me across the back of my head and was gone. I have had more hairstyles than most men of my age have had hot dinners. It doesn't take a genius to work out that part of the reason I've so enjoyed changing the colour, length and look of my follicles over the years is something to do with reclaiming the power my father took from me in this regard, as well as many others, as a child. After I'd left home and was free from my father's grip, I managed to make my hair a symbol of my own freedom. My hair has been blonde, it's been short and spiky, long and floppy, sleek, shaggy, and everything in between. I've even shaved my own head more than once. I suppose what I'm saying is, I'm okay. I survived my father. It took a while to get to this place, though. Friday, the 21st of May, 2010. I am in London to prepare for the filming of an episode of the BBC's Who Do You Think You Are? A programme in which celebrities have their genealogy investigated, and studious, balding men in tweed jackets with leather patches on the elbows help the celebs pore over ancient parchments wherein family secrets are hidden. But not for long, of course, as a hitherto unpredictable secret is revealed, and then the celeb cries. When I'd been asked if I'd be interested in taking part in the show, I immediately said yes. It would give me the opportunity to get to the bottom of a mystery in my mum's side of the family, a mystery which concerned my maternal grandfather, Thomas Darling. Although my mum, Mary, kept the surname Cumming after her divorce from my father, she is known to me, my brother Tom, and all our friends by her maiden name, Mary Darling. She isn't Mary, she is Mary Darling. This is mostly because her name so suits her. She is a darling. She had been getting more and more excited about the start of filming. It was her father that the show was going to discuss, after all. A man she last saw when she was 8 years old, although he hadn't died until she was 13, 5 years later, in 1951. This is what I knew. Tommy Darling was from the north of England and was orphaned at age 2. He had married my granny and had 4 children. He was a decorated soldier in the Second World War, but after the war ended, Tommy Darling never came home. He joined the Malayan police force and died there in a shooting accident and was buried in neighbouring Singapore. But why had he never returned to his family? And what exactly were the circumstances of this shooting accident? At my granny's funeral, I asked an old friend of hers about it. "Well, they called it an accident," was his enigmatic comment. Mary Darling had left a message earlier that morning. There had been a reporter from a Sunday tabloid at her door. This wasn't unusual. Over the years, my mum had encountered several reporters on her doorstep, trying to get a comment from her about something or someone I had been rumoured to have done or said. Now she was quite an old hand at it. She said that this time the reporter was asking about my father, wanting to find out where he lived so they could ask him for a comment about something I'd said in a recent interview. My father had been estranged from his family for many years by this point. The press had made several attempts over the decades to goad Mr. Cummings Sr. into having his say about his lack of relationship with me. I knew exactly which comments they would have latched onto. I'd done a wide-ranging interview in support of The Good Wife, the television show I'd recently joined the cast of. As we were finishing, the reporter asked if I thought I would ever see my father again. I said that I'd thought about this a lot. My father had contacted my brother out of the blue earlier in the year to tell him he was battling with cancer. So I imagined that the only way we might have any contact would be if he reached out as he was dying. However, the in-depth interview was scrapped in favour of one of those shorter, pithier, what I've learned pieces, and a selection of my words was assembled randomly under topic headings that bore little relation to the context in which they were uttered. My life is so much better now that my father is not in it. Maybe next time I see him he'll be really ill, or he'll be dying, and I may not see him, is how the mashup ran. No wonder the papers were sniffing about. That evening, I was in my London flat, having a laugh with old friends. Sue and I had met many years ago at the Donmar Warehouse, where I was playing Hamlet, followed by my turn as the MC in Cabaret that later transferred to Broadway, and we've been best friends ever since. When people ask how we met, Sue likes to tell them she washed my undies, and indeed she did, for she was a member of that most noble of professions, the theatre dresser. When she married Dom, I and our other bestie, Andrew, were male bridesmaids, stifling our giggles as Sue walked down the aisle to Elvis, singing, "It's Now or Never." As the wine flowed and the laughter rose, Sue's phone rang. "Hi, Tom," she said. "Oh, he's here." I wondered why my big brother would call Sue and not me to find out my whereabouts. Sue passed me her phone, and immediately I knew something was wrong. "How are you doing?" Tom asked, a little shaky. Obviously, he hadn't intended to speak to me. "I really need to talk to you, Alan." "Tom, what's wrong?" "I can't tell you on the phone." "Is it your health?" My mind immediately raced to the worst possible scenarios. My brother is a rock. If he acted like this, it meant there was really something badly wrong. "Is something wrong with Mum?" But I'd spoken to Mary Darling several times that week. There was no way she could have hidden anything bad from me. Suddenly, I remembered what she'd said about the reporter. "Is it something to do with that reporter guy looking for Dad?" "It's all come to a head, Alan," was Tom's response. "I need to see you tonight." It took Tom 3 hours to get to me. He lives in Southampton and had to catch a train. I had to endure 3 whole hours of my mind racing and my heart thumping. I was a mess. If I had had the ability at that moment to be rational, I would have realised that there was nothing particularly scandalous about my life that had not been revealed before now, and I might have taken solace from having become an open book. But I was finding it hard to see solace anywhere. I started to get wheezy. I have asthma, and it comes on during moments of great stress. Sue is luckily a self-confessed hypochondriac and an expert on all homeopathic remedies, so before too long, I had a mouthful of pills to distract me. But the anxiety persisted. I kept replaying our phone conversation. Had my father died? Was it something to do with my husband, Grant? He was heading back to our home in New York City now. Could something have happened to him? By the time Tom arrived, I felt I had aged 10 years. There were a few awkward moments of small talk, and then he looked at me. "Shall we go upstairs?" Tom is sitting across the table from me on the roof terrace of my flat. He stammers and makes several false starts. I beg him to just say it, to just tell me. I'm going mad with the waiting. At first he apologises because he has already told Grant. He says he didn't know how best to tell me, and so he called Grant for advice. Everything was whirring. My thoughts, Tom's voice, the skyline of Soho all around us. He finally manages to get out that our father had called him 10 days ago. "What did he say?" I whispered. I was shaking. I'd started to cry. "Please, Tom, please." Tom gulped, and finally he said it. "He told me to tell you that you're not his son."
Alan Cumming continues to read from his memoir, Not My Father's Son, at the same time tomorrow. The abridger was Sarah Davis and the producer was Elizabeth Allard. For details of organisations which offer advice and support about the issues raised, go online to bbc.co.uk/actionline or call the Radio 4 Action Line to hear recorded information on 0800 044 044. Lines are open 24 hours and are free for most landlines. Some networks and mobile operators will charge for these calls. Women's football, education for girls and part-time working. It's all in a couple of minutes.
What can you do in 4 minutes? Boil an egg? Change a light bulb? Perhaps. But with Radio 4 in 4 minutes, it's long enough to feed your curiosity.
Human beings should not live together, and children should be taken from their parents at an early age.
It's all electronic, but it sounds as if it's got an acoustic.
This is Diotima's teaching. To learn about beauty, first recognize the physical beauty of your desired lover. Then, if you're rational, you'll appreciate not just the individual loved one's beauty, but also the physical beauty of others, too.
Explore Radio 4 in 4 on the BBC Radio 4 website.